Our guest this hour is here to help us believe in the radical power of fermented food. Chances are you know someone these days who makes their own kombucha or fermented tea, and everyone's had yogurt and sourdough bread. But fermented food is more than a trend to Sandor Katz. It's a way of life, a path to better health, and a form of activism. I'm Veronica Rickert, keeping you company today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sandor Katz is a self-taught fermentation expert and the author of The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, which Newsweek has called the Fermenting Bible. And Sandor Katz, it's great to have you with us.
It's so good to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So when we use the word fermentation, what are we talking about?
Well, broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. If you have a biology background, biologists mean something more specific when they talk about fermentation, and that is, fermentation is the production of energy without oxygen, anaerobic metabolism, and in that sense, the cells of our bodies are capable of fermentation. And most of the most widespread classic fermented foods and beverages, alcoholic beverages, yogurt, sauerkraut, many of them do fit the biologist definition, but there are certain ferments that require oxygen. Vinegar, kombucha, tempeh, molded cheeses are a few examples. So I prefer to work with this sort of broader lay definition that fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. But we do generally reserve this term to describe intentional or desirable transformations by microorganisms. So we don't call rotten food or spoiled food or our compost pile fermentation necessarily.
Well, home fermentation is a huge movement, and it's growing. Michael Pollan calls people who are enthusiastic home fermenters fermentos, which I love. Why are people so pumped up about home fermenting right now?
Well, I mean, let me just point out that, everybody eats fermented foods every day. Probably most people listening to this show have already had something fermented today. Coffee involves fermentation. All bread involves fermentation. Cheese involves fermentation. So, ferments are such, basic elemental parts of our diets that, it's part of agriculture. It's an integral part of every culinary tradition on this earth. And it's really only within the last couple of generations that people have stopped doing it, in their homes and in their communities, as we have been, basically severed from the sources of our food and from, the food practices of our ancestors. We've become alienated from this really important process. And because, something that's happened at the same time as this distancing is, the science of microbiology and its first triumphs were identifying pathogenic bacteria. So as a culture, we have developed, a huge fear of bacteria. And so it's just in recent years that we're seeing a little bit of a revival of something that always has been part of our households and our communities. And I think the reason for this is, it's just part of the broader interest in becoming more connected to our food again, the relocalization of our food, the revival of local markets for food, because fermentation is really just an integral aspect of agriculture, this is bringing about a renewal of interest in fermentation.
So you're light years ahead of where I am in terms of making your own food and being comfortable doing this stuff. I canned for the first time this year by myself, and I was terrified. Like, every step of the way, I was terrified. And then when I ate the tomatoes, I was terrified. And then you look at something like fermenting, and we're talking about mold and bacteria and yeast. And this is stuff that our culture right now is telling us to be afraid of, right? There's Purell dispensers everywhere you go. We're hearing about nightmare bacteria. So how do you separate the fear from, what you're doing here and reclaiming this part of our culinary heritage?
Well, I mean, one thing we can do is look at statistics. There has never, ever, ever been a single documented case of food poisoning in the United States from fermented vegetables. There are very few foods that you can say that about. This is an extremely safe food. I mean, we hear every year about people getting sick from raw vegetables, from, you know, lettuce, tomatoes, spinach. It's one thing after another. And so, you know, this suggests that actually the fermentation makes the vegetables safer. Hmm. If vegetables have been subjected to some kind of incidental contamination, you know, the fermentation by basically putting to work the indigenous population of bacteria on the vegetables, which include lactic acid bacteria, they create an environment which cannot sustain the pathogenic bacteria which might, which it could come into contact with. So really, fermentation is a strategy for safety. But yeah, I mean, it's hard for, you know, it's impossible for lay people to sort of, you know, see the bacteria, know what bacteria are there. And so, you know, we really have to, you know, rely upon, what I would call, you know, an understanding of what kind of conditions we're trying to create. What every fermentation amounts to at a practical level is manipulating environmental conditions to encourage the growth of certain organisms while simultaneously discouraging the growth of other kinds of organisms. So with vegetables, you know, the big secret is get them submerged under liquid. With sauerkraut, it would be under its own juices. You salt the vegetables, you squeeze them or pound them a little bit to get some of their juices out, and then stuff them in a jar tightly so that the vegetables get submerged under their own juices. And the way we're manipulating environmental conditions when we do that is that we're depriving the vegetables of access to air. And the molds can't grow without air. And so what grows when air is not present, when oxygen isn't present, are lactic acid bacteria, which acidify the environment and make it impossible for anything we would regard as pathogenic to exist in that environment. With each ferment, it's really a matter of just, you know, having an understanding of what kind of environmental conditions you're trying to create, and also to some degree, you know, trusting in the wisdom of our ancestors. Mm. I would point out that, you know, I mean, canning, I mean, I think canning is a very practical art. It's wonderful that you're doing it. Canning is a completely modern practice. It was invented in the 19th century in France. In France, they still call canned food canning apertization because they remember of the name of the man who invented the process. And canning is kind of the diametrical opposite of fermentation. Whereas in fermentation, we are, cultivating the growth of bacteria, which are going to preserve the food. In canning, we're trying to sterilize it. And so, you know, really, all the dangers that we associate with food preservation come from canning, because if we fail to kill all the bacteria, you know, the one that survives the highest temperatures is Clostridium botulinum.
Botulism.
Which causes botulism. When you're working with raw ingredients, you don't really need to worry about this.
So you're saying fermentation is much safer than canning, and I should be terrified.
No, I'm not saying you should be terrified.
No, I know.
I mean, it sounds like you have a clear idea of the parameters for safety, and the USDA does a great job of publishing these guides that say with different types of vegetables, based on their acidity, how long you need to pressure cook them for, to be sure that you kill the botulism.
Well, another way to get involved in this fermenting thing, you've been talking about, you know, the bacteria work and submerging and creating this acidic environment for the vegetables. Another way to approach this is through the taste buds, through taste. And as I understand it, you know, you take something like a pickle, a grocery store pickle, and then you take a pickle that has been prepared, you know, by hand at home through home fermentation, and that the taste difference is kind of out of this world.
Yeah, sure. And well, I mean, there's a couple of things going on there. I mean, you could make vinegar pickles at home, but I think it's important to understand the distinction between vinegar pickles and fermented pickles. So what pickling means broadly is preserving anything in an acidic environment. And there's a couple of ways of accomplishing this. The classic way is in a brine, in a salt water solution, which is an environment that supports the growth of lactic acid bacteria, and then they acidify the environment through the byproduct of their fermentation, which is lactic acid. Now, acetic acid, vinegar, is a product of fermentation. It is fermented by a bacteria called Acetobacter from alcohol. And vinegar, but vinegar pickles typically involve heating the vinegar and pouring a hot vinegar solution over vegetables. And the heat sterilizes the vegetables, and then the acid preserves them. So you know, pickles just describe a range of products. A hot vinegar pickled product does not have living bacteria in it, whereas a fermented pickle does. It's really only in the 20th century that vinegar pickling became widespread and popular and superseded lactic acid fermentation pickles.
What does a fermented pickle taste like to you?
Oh my God! One of the most delicious things in the world. I mean, that's how I got involved in fermentation. Is you know, as a kid growing up in New York City, I loved what we call in New York City sour pickles, what are known outside of New York mostly as kosher dills. And these are, you know, garlicky, dill-flavored cucumber pickles that are fermented. And, you know, just even right now, just talking about it, like I'm feeling, you know, my salivary glands, you know, producing saliva, you know, just like they're such a strong trigger for all of my digestive juices. You know, the really good ones are, you know, crunchy, garlicky, and you know, really, really sour. They make you pucker when you eat them, and it's just one of the most lovely flavors in the world to me.
Oh, it just sounds pretty fantastic, I have to say. So if someone were to want to take baby steps fermenting their food, where would they start?
Well, I would definitely recommend, you know, sauerkraut or, you know, fermented vegetables more broadly, because really, you know, the same method process you can really apply to virtually any vegetable, and you can be, you know, very experimental and improvisational. But, you know, basically, you know, the reason why it's the perfect way to start is it is intrinsically safe. You don't need any special starter cultures. You don't need any special equipments. You can just do it in a jar, and that's what I would recommend. You know, find a quart jar. If it has a wide mouth, it'll be a little bit easier, but you could work with any kind of a jar. It'll take about 2 pounds of vegetables to fill that jar. You could use cabbage. You could use turnips. You could use radishes. You could use carrots. You could mix lots of different vegetables together. You know, chopping them or grating them creates surface area. What we're trying to do with something like sauerkraut is pull the water out of the vegetables rather than add more water, and creating surface area facilitates that. But you can chop them finely or coarsely. It doesn't really matter. Salt lightly to taste. Salt lightly, mix them up and taste it, and then add a little bit more salt if you want. But it's always easier to add salt than it is to subtract salt. And then spend about 5 minutes with your hands just squeezing the vegetables. What you're trying to do is bruise the vegetables, break down cell walls, and get the vegetables to release their juices. Then once the vegetables feel nice and juicy and you can pick up a handful and squeeze it and have juice come out like you're squeezing a sponge, then just stuff those salted vegetables into the jar and leave it on your kitchen counter. You can't just put this in the closet and forget about it, because pressure is going to be building up in that jar as carbon dioxide is produced as a byproduct of this fermentation process. And so what I like to do is just leave it on the counter, and every morning when I get up and I start making my tea, I release the pressure. I just open it up a crack and release the pressure, and then I might take off the lid and press down and make sure all the vegetables really get submerged, because they have a tendency to float to the top. And then after a couple of days, start tasting it. You know, there's no, you know, magic amount of time when it's done. You know, people like it at different stages of its development, and some people like it really acidic, tangy, and that takes time to develop. Some people prefer it more mild. So really, if you start tasting it after 2 or 3 days and then taste it at regular intervals, you get a sense of the spectrum of flavors and figure out what you like. And that's one of the beautiful things about making something for yourself at home, is you can make it the way you like it. And if you don't know what that is, then a little bit of, you know, experimentation and tasting it over time is how you will learn.
That doesn't sound too bad.
No, I mean, it's it's incredibly easy, incredibly safe. You know, if you buy a couple of pounds of vegetables, you already have everything else you need at home. And it's fun and delicious. And, you know, I mean, I find that I eat a lot better when I have it around, because when I do a, you know, just a quick meal, a sandwich, a quesadilla or something, you know, I have these beautiful, vibrant, probiotic fermented vegetables that I can put on it or eat with it.
Now, I want to talk about probiotics, because they are becoming a major watchword in health circles these days, and everyone is popping their probiotics. I don't know, I pay maybe $20 for what I feel like is a decent one at the store. But it sounds like if you're eating these fermented foods, that you can really stock up on these live cultures right in your food. Skip the supplement.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that, you know, over the last decade or so, you know, we've been seeing, you know, something of a revolution in how we are viewing and understanding our bodies. I mean, you know, all of us who grew up in the second half of the, you know, 20th century, you know, grew up with the idea that bacteria are our enemies and we should kill them. We should eradicate them. I mean, you know, look at the marketing of antibacterial soaps, you know, the appeal of, you know, something promising to kill 99.9% of bacteria. But as it turns out, it is not at all desirable to kill 99.9% of bacteria, because, you know, 90% of the cells in our bodies are bacterial cells. You know, for the last decades, scientists have been observing that, you know, the cells of our bodies that reflect our own unique individual DNA code are actually outnumbered 10 to 1 by bacteria that we're host to. And these are not our enemies. They are not parasites. They are not hurting us. They actually give us a huge amount of our functionality. You know, to begin with, human beings could not reproduce without bacteria. Actually, women's bodies produce a glycogen, a carbohydrate that specifically supports a population of lactic acid bacteria that create an acidic environment that enables human beings to reproduce. So, you know, from the get-go, we could not reproduce without fermenting bacteria. Then bacteria in our gut enable us to digest food and assimilate nutrients. They synthesize certain essential nutrients for us. And it's becoming increasingly clear, although the mechanisms are still somewhat murky, that what we call our immune system is mediated by bacteria in our gut. There's new research suggesting that you know, our brain chemistry is regulated by gut bacteria. So on the one hand, you know, all these aspects of our functionality you know, depend upon bacteria, involve bacteria. You know, bacteria really are part of our bodies, and yet we have this ideology telling us that we should kill all the bacteria. So anyway, I mean, probiotics is really, you know, one of the ways that we're seeing people looking to bacteria to ameliorate their health. You know, and there's a tremendous body of research, mostly about specific proprietary probiotic agents. Only a very little bit of it about actual foods. And certainly, you know, the voice of the probiotic capsule industry would say that, you know, you can't be sure with traditional foods that you're getting, you know, as good a bacterial mix. But actually, there's some research suggesting that by eating a diversity of live culture fermented foods, you actually can get much superior immune stimulation than you can from, you know, repeating the same probiotic mix. So, I mean, the study that I'm thinking of was done in Spain, where they recruited a group of volunteers who, you know, regularly eat a diversity of fermented foods, you know, everything from, you know, olives, cheeses, yogurt, you know, lots of different, even salamis was in it. And then they did some baseline blood work where they looked at immune globulin and a couple of other markers of immune functioning. And then they put people on a deprivation diet where they couldn't have any of their favorite bacterially rich foods. And then after a few weeks of deprivation, they did another round of blood work, and everybody's levels of immune globulin and these other indicators was suppressed as a result of lack of bacterial stimulation.
Wow.
Then they put half the group on traditional yogurt and half the group on new improved probiotic yogurt. Both groups regained approximately equal levels of their immune markers, but nobody regained the the full level that they had been at the beginning until they were allowed to resume their diet that involved varied traditional fermented foods.
Oh, well, that's pretty compelling right there. Well, we're talking with Sander Katz this hour. He is a self-taught fermentation expert and the author of The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, which Newsweek, by the way, called the Fermenting Bible. And we'd love to hear your questions and comments about how to ferment your own food, what works, maybe what have you tried, and we can get into health a little bit more as well. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@wpr.org. And you'll also find some links to videos of Sander Katz explaining some of the various fermentation processes like sauerkraut on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Sander Alex Katz, who is a self-taught fermentation expert, the author of The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation. And he's here to get us excited about fermentation. We've been talking about the health benefits and how you can try it at home. And we have a bit on our Facebook page, too, of Sander talking us through some of the various techniques. And we go next to Jim, who is joining us in Cedarburg. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for the show.
You're welcome.
I have some 60-year-old cherry wine that was put up in glass gallon jugs, a regular screw cap that obviously allowed the wine to go bad, turn to vinegar. Is there a safeguard, some way to test it before I would try to use the vinegar?
Test it. You mean to see if it's okay?
I don't want to poison anybody here.
Well, you know, in the wine to vinegar spectrum, I mean, both alcohol and vinegar, you know, really will kill bacteria that could be harmful to us. So you don't really need to worry too much about it. I would say, you know, the worst case scenario is getting some, you know, off flavors like acetone, which is a sort of, you know, an incomplete metabolism, to acetic acid. But you don't have to worry about, you know, botulism or, the worst is it's just going to not taste good and you won't want to drink it. Or if it's very acidic, that you'll use it as vinegar and make salad dressings out of it rather than drinking it as wine.
Well, there you go, Jim. Enjoy your vinegar there. And let's go to Marilyn. Marilyn joins us next from Montfort. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. How are you?
Well, how are you?
My husband goes into a swoon talking about half-sour pickles. And I've never seen them or known where to get them. Could you tell something about that and
sure.
You might find them or make them?
Well, I mean, I could tell you. I mean, in New York City, they're easy to find. It's the same as a sour pickle. It's a lactic acid pickle, but a half sour typically is made in a less salty brine and fermented for less time, so it gets less acidic. So it's just, you know, let's call it a partially fermented pickle. And it's just, you know, some people prefer the flavor of a half sour pickle to a sour pickle. If you come to a delicatessen in New York, you know, probably a delicatessen in Chicago or you know, any city with like a classic delicatessen, you could find a half sour pickle, or you could make one. And, you know, the way you would make it is you would take, small pickling cucumbers and mix up a 3.5% brine. What that means is, you figure out how much water you have. It's all based on weight. It's very easy in the metric system because a liter weighs a kilogram. So if you had a liter of water, you would basically take 35 grams of salt. mix that into the water, and you'd have a 3.5% brine, and then you'd put your cucumbers in there. You'd use as little brine as possible to cover your cucumbers, usually some grape leaves or oak leaves or sour cherry leaves or horseradish leaves to help keep the cucumbers crunchy, lots of garlic, lots of dill. And then ferment them for, the amount of time really depends a lot on the temperature. If we're talking the heat of summer, it might just be a few days. If you have a cooler spot or it's a cooler season, it may take a couple of weeks. The only way I know to evaluate it is by tasting pickles stopping the process when they reach your liking by moving them into the refrigerator, your fermentation slowing device.
Ah, well, tasting pickles, that doesn't sound like a bad way to figure it out.
I do have a on my website, which is wildfermentation.com, I do have a pickle recipe. I mean, it's really a sour pickle recipe with a slightly stronger brine, but you could just mix up a weaker brine and use, basically the same process as described in that recipe.
So, Sander, what is your favorite thing to ferment? Is it a pickle or something else?
Oh my God, that's so hard. I just love so many different kinds of ferments. I love pickles a lot. Right now I'm sort of getting near the bottom of my 55-gallon barrel of radish kraut, and I really love that. I love making savory vegetable sourdough pancakes. I work with my sourdough every few days doing that. I love to eat yogurt. Like many of your listeners, I love to drink beer. Chocolate is fermented. Coffee is fermented. There's really many, many, many different types of ferments that I enjoy, and I would hate to have to just pick one.
Those fermented vegetable sourdough pancakes, now those sound interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I just take my sourdough, and a sourdough is you make a sourdough just by mixing flour and water, and then it will start to bubble, and then you have to keep on feeding it, and then you have a relationship and a little pet that you have to keep on feeding if you want to perpetuate it. So I mix my sourdough starter with a little bit more flour and water. Let's see, the last one that I made, I grated a sweet potato into it. Then I fried an onion and put the fried onion into it. I grated a little bit of cheese into it, and I mixed an egg in with it. And, yesterday me and several friends who were around, had two meals of pancakes like this.
Wow, that sounds great, I gotta say.
With a yogurt and hot sauce.
Is there a recipe for that in your book?
My new book, The Art of Fermentation, I have really tried to get away from the recipe format. There's a very detailed description of how I do that, but it's not exactly in the form of a recipe. Because the way I actually do it is just through the year, as the types of vegetables that are in my garden and in my pantry shift, I make it with lots of different things. So it really just depends, what's around. In the summer I might make it with okra. In the fall I might make it with turnips. I mean, it just really depends what I have abundantly available. And really, most of the ferments evolved as practical responses to seasonality, to, things being overly abundant at a particular moment of the year and then things being not available at other parts of the year. So it's a way to, preserve food from periods of relative abundance to get us through periods of relative scarcity. And so, I've just tried to get away from the specific recipe format, but give people lots of information about how the process works, what are the concepts behind it, what are some of the different kinds of ingredients or different types of proportions that I've used or sampled or heard about people using, and just give people a menu of possibilities. And let it be a point of departure for improvisation and experimentation.
Great. Well, I want to get to some emails here. This is one from Samantha, who says, "When I was little, my mom made some sauerkraut in a crock pot. She ate it and got sick. What went wrong, and how do you know when you should not eat your sauerkraut?"
Well, I mean, the problems that can happen with sauerkraut generally are abundantly visible.
Mold?
Surface molds. I mean, that's very, I mean, really, like, remember I described earlier, like, that, you know, if you just leave a cabbage exposed to the air, it will develop molds. If you submerge it under liquid, the lactic acid bacteria will grow, and the molds can't grow. But unless you're working in some sort of a vessel that is engineered to keep air out, and there are some very clever designs of that, then, you know, your surface is the place where the ecosystems meet, where, you know, where the cabbage or the juice coming off of the cabbage comes into contact with the air. And so it's prone to all sorts of aerobic organisms growing, yeasts as well as molds. And so sometimes there is just a growth on the surface. You know, typically they're really harmless white molds, and in some traditions they actually mix them back in. I don't like to mix them back in. I like to scrape them off as best I can. And underneath it, the sauerkraut, you know, generally smells and tastes fine. You know, I don't know what to tell her about, like, you know, her mother having gotten sick. I mean, the USDA tells us that there never has been a documented case of food poisoning. Now, not every time someone gets sick related to food, is it food poisoning? You know, it could be from something else that she ate, and that all these years everyone assumed it was the sauerkraut. I mean, I just don't know. But really, like, the problems that can happen with sauerkraut are not invisible problems. They are problems that you can see, and problems that you can smell.
Okay, well, thank you for the email, Samantha. And next to Jim in Mequon. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, great show. Great show. This is close to my heart, or I should say stomach. I work as a lab specialist at a UW campus, and I was delighted when our new microbiology teacher decided to do a fermentation lab where the students we'll make kimchi and sauerkraut and yogurt and sometimes some soft cheeses. And being an old kimchi maker, it's been a lot of fun working with her and the students doing, you know, coming up with different recipes. And it is a lot of fun. It's a great learning experience. The students are somewhat hesitant to try the product, which leaves more of the leftovers for me. But it is.
And that's more of this, like, just fear, this rampant fear in our culture of bacteria, yet everybody's favorite foods are products of fermentation. You walk into a gourmet food store and almost everything is a product of fermentation, you know, and yet we have this residual fear of bacteria. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's fine. And as an aside, my wife makes me eat my kimchi outside. So thank you very much. This is a great educational experience, and I will check out your website and maybe give you an email.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Jim. Appreciate that. And yeah, kimchi is another popular one. Didn't you say the Koreans have, have different words for you know, a taste on the tongue and a taste by hand, and that the kimchi is really sort of this art of fermenting things by hand and has this richness of flavor.
Right, sure. No, I mean, Michael Pollan wrote in the foreword to my book about this Korean concept of hand taste, you know, and that's really, you know, just sort of the... you know, like almost the personality or the essence of the person who is preparing it, you know, becoming part of the food.
Well, we're talking this hour with Sandor Katz, who's a self-taught fermentation expert and the author of The Art of Fermentation. And we're getting all of our questions answered this hour about fermentation, how it works, the health benefits, and how to give it a try. And we'd love to take your phone calls this hour about your own experiments, your own forays into fermenting food. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk with Sandor Katz, who is a self-taught fermentation expert and the author of The Art of Fermentation, talking about all of these fermented foods that we can make at home, things like yogurt and sauerkraut and kimchi, and just exploring the vast world of fermented foods that are out there. And we have an email here. asking, what health benefits do you get from kombucha? And that's something that is interesting to me. It's been fascinating to sort of watch how kombucha has rocketed off in the past few years. In Madison, Wisconsin here, we have homemade kombucha everywhere you look. I had it at the home of a friend for the first time years ago. And along with that kombucha came a story about these incredible health benefits. What do you know about that?
Well, I mean, I really enjoy kombucha. I think kombucha is a lovely beverage to drink. I do have a bit of a sense that kombucha is being a little bit overemphasized. I do not believe that kombucha is uniquely healthful. I think that, like all live culture foods, there are some health benefits to it, but I don't think that it is superior to eating yogurt or eating sauerkraut. And really, I think that the greatest benefits we can derive are from diversity, from ingesting a variety of different types of fermented foods and beverages. So, I mean, I think kombucha is wonderful, but I really don't think that it is the singular answer to all of our problems, and I do think that there has been a certain amount of unsubstantiated hype about it. Let me just address, for fermented foods in general, some of the ways that they transform foods and beverages nutritionally, and what kinds of benefits they can bring to us. First of all, pre-digestion. Fermented foods are pre-digested, meaning that dense compound nutrients that can be difficult for us to digest get digested before we eat them, and often that makes the nutrients more available to us. I think the most dramatic example of this would be soybeans. The reasons why the vegetarian subculture, adopted soybeans as an almost singular replacement for meat and milk is that soybeans are the plant source food that has the most concentrated protein. But our human digestive systems do not have the capability of digesting the soybeans or assimilating the protein from the soybeans. So the Asian cultures that pioneered soy agriculture, all fermented the soybeans in different ways. There's soy sauce, there's miso, there's tempeh, there's natto, many other variations. These foods are very different from one another in their flavors and their textures, but what they all have in common is that protein gets broken down during the fermentation into amino acids that are the building blocks of protein. And as a result, the nutrients in that bean become much more bioavailable to us. Similarly, lactose gets broken down by fermentation, even gluten. So many, many dense, hard-to-digest nutrients can be pre-digested to some degree by fermentation. Then the nutrients can actually be augmented during fermentation. So most fermented foods have elevated levels of B vitamins compared to the raw foods that you begin with. And then in addition, there are these, sort of metabolic byproducts of the ferments that are unique micronutrients in and of themselves, so that sauerkraut and other forms of fermented vegetables contain these compounds called isothiocyanates, which were already regarded as potent anti-carcinogenic compounds. Natto, this Japanese soy ferment, which has never really caught on in the West, mostly because it makes the soybeans slimy, there's an extract of it, specifically of that sliminess, actually, that's being marketed as a nutritional supplement called natto kinase. And the reason it's so popular as a nutritional supplement is that it's been found to help dissolve fiber accumulations in blood vessels, which actually has tremendous therapeutic application. These unique micronutrients that are byproducts of fermentation processes are just really beginning to be identified. Certain foods can be detoxified by fermentation. Dramatic toxins like cyanide in cassava, or less dramatic toxins like oxalic acid or phytic acid, which is found in grains and legumes and seeds and nuts. But the fermentation can remove those toxins and make the foods more nutritious that way. And then finally, there are the live bacterial cultures themselves, and not all fermented foods have live bacterial cultures. Bread is fermented, but then it goes into a hot oven, and so baked bread no longer has intact live cultures. You know, also, you know, some food is pasteurized, you know, or canned, just for shelf stability, for convenience. So the live cultures are no longer present. But foods that are fermented by bacteria, particularly lactic acid bacteria, and then are not heated up after their fermentation, the live bacterial, their cultures themselves, can have a stimulating effect in our bodies. They can help to, replenish and diversify the bacteria in our gut. They can contribute to better overall digestion, better assimilation of nutrients in our food, better immune functioning, as well as other aspects of our physiology that we began discussing earlier that are just, beginning to be understood. But as I said earlier, it's really like our greatest bacterial stimulation comes from diversity rather than from any single probiotic agent or any single food. So as much as I love kombucha, I don't think that it alone has these unique benefits. I think, like all of the foods and beverages that have live bacterial cultures, really can, help to, improve our overall functioning. I hesitate to make any kind of, specific claims of disease cures, and I think it is problematic to, claim that, specific foods will cure specific diseases. I think that, foods with live bacterial cultures have the potential to dramatically improve our digestion, our nutrient assimilation, and our overall immune functioning. And that is tremendous. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you have been, diagnosed with a terrible acute disease, if you've been living with some chronic condition for decades, if you're the healthiest specimen walking the earth, if you're feeling the effects of aging, no matter what the status of your health, improved digestion, nutrient assimilation, and immune functioning can only help you.
Well, thank you. That's compelling to hear all of that. Thank you for running us through some of the health benefits there. And let's go next to Paul, who's joining us from Little Suamico. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I had a comment and a couple of questions. I have a friend that says him and his mother make homemade sauerkraut, and what they make it in is a 5-gallon bucket, layer cabbage and salt, and then mash it with a baseball bat, and then they put a wooden board over the sauerkraut with a weight on it, like a stone or something. Also, I had a question as far as if there's a limit to what types of vegetable you can ferment. Could you do, like, say, carrots and Brussels sprouts? And is there a specific time when you can, say, put these vegetables into a sealed glass jar and store them, and what type of shelf life would they have?
Okay. Well, okay, it sounds like your friend's method is totally classic. And, I describe the method with a jar, just assuming the people who are listening who've never done it before, are most likely to do it if they don't need to get any special equipment. And really, to make a small amount of sauerkraut, you don't need any special equipment. But certainly, if you get into doing it and want to do larger batches, it's great to get special equipment. And the only thing I do differently than what your friend describes is, instead of using a plastic bucket, I prefer to use a ceramic crock, but I put a plate that fits inside of it, sitting on top of the vegetables, and a weight, which usually for me is a jug filled with water, bearing down on that, and then I just cover the whole thing with a cloth to keep flies out. It's a versatile process that you can use different kinds of vessels. Really classically, it's even been done in pits in the ground. what vegetables? Certainly you can do with carrots and Brussels sprouts. You could do with pretty much any different kind of vegetable. I met a woman whose grandmother was from a town in Poland where they put mashed potatoes in their sauerkraut. So, you can actually incorporate cooked foods along with raw foods if you like. You just always want to cool them down before you add them. You can make sauerkraut out of kale. I can't tell you if you're going to like it or not. The dark green vegetables with a lot of chlorophyll have a very strong flavor when they ferment. So I just encourage people when they're experimenting to experiment in small batches so you can make sure you actually like what you're making, rather than, putting 40 pounds of vegetables in and then discovering that you don't like
I want to ask you about the fermentation crock, because we had someone else, Terry in Oconomowoc, asking about that. Do you have any tips on buying one or where to get them?
On buying a crock?
Yeah.
The best bet is if you can find some local old-timey hardware store that carries them, because then you won't pay for shipping. I know that the hardware chain Ace has a website where they sell them, and then they will deliver them free to any of their affiliated stores.
What do they look like?
The ones I mostly use are just simple cylindrical crocks. Very, very simple shape. Although there are lots of shapes. I mean, in the Asian tradition, often people work with like a pot belly kind of a shape. There are these elegantly designed crocks being imported from Germany, known as harsh crocks, H-A-R-S-C-H. I find myself just combing through when I'm in thrift stores, just looking in the houseware sections and seeing, you know, what kinds of, the inserts for electric crock pots that are ceramic work great as fermentation vessels. Often things designed as cookie jars or things like that will work. You really can be improvisational, or you can purchase a beautiful classic crock if you like. Let me just talk about the timing, which the caller asked about.
Mm-hmm.
The classic time to put up sauerkraut is in the autumn, as the temperatures are going down. You certainly can make kraut at any time of the year, but you need to understand that there's a relationship between the temperature and the speed of fermentation. The metabolism of all these organisms speeds up when it's warmer. So for longest preservation, if you make it when the temperatures are going down and have a cool place to store it, like a root cellar or some other unheated space where it also won't freeze, then you'll have the maximum time horizon on your project. You could make it in October up there and eat it all winter, and it'll be fine up until the next summer when it gets hot again. Now, in the sealed jar method, what you have to be aware of is that pressure is going to build up. So especially in the first week or so, it's really important to just release some of that pressure. The carbon dioxide production will go down dramatically as the process proceeds. So, after a week or two, then you really could put it away in a closet. And if you have a cool place to store it, meaning somewhere around Earth temperature, it should last a salty, acidic, full jar of sauerkraut should last for years. If you just have a room temperature environment to leave it in, the problem that will develop is that the vegetables will get mushy. They'll lose all of their texture and resistance, and that's when I throw it into the compost, is when they get all mushy. And that's just enzymes that break down the pectins. They're called pectinase enzymes, and eventually they'll develop faster in a warmer environment, but eventually they will just turn your vegetables into mush.
Well, thanks a lot for the call, Paul. And as we go out here, Sandra, I want to ask you, now you have written that fermentation is a spiritual path and it's also a form of activism. It's pretty strong things to say about a method of food preparation. Why is fermentation a spiritual path and activism?
Well, okay. I mean, in terms of a spiritual path, I mean, look, here you are interacting with these invisible life forces. I mean, fermentation has always been viewed as a mystical force, and there's a huge amount of ritual in indigenous cultures around the world that's organized around fermentation, and you can even look at some of the religious traditions that have turned into the major world religion. I mean, look at the Roman Catholic Mass. It's not some random substance that transubstantiates into the blood of Jesus Christ. It's wine. So religious iconography is full of products of fermentation, and it's just a mystical practice. And when you get involved doing it, you start sort of feeling this connection to these invisible life forces. And I would say in my own case, it has been a very spiritual thing, and I've heard that from lots of other fermentation practitioners and enthusiasts. In terms of activism, I mean, I think that, people are really waking up to the fact that it is not desirable to have centralized mass production of all of our food, and that, many essential things are lost in the process, and that the technology that allows for centralized mass production of our food is producing, you know, nutritionally diminished food. It's destroying the environment. It's destroying any kind of underpinnings of economic security. And I think that, you know, it's just, you know, hugely important that we reclaim our food. And I think that, you know, many people are waking up to this, and, you know, agriculture is part of it, but fermentation is an essential part of agriculture, and it's part of reclaiming our food.
Well, thank you so much, Sander. I think I'm going to have to try this mystical art of fermentation. It sounds fantastic. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sander Alex Katz is a self-taught fermentation expert and the author of The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, which Newsweek has called the Fermenting Bible. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour, Jennifer Dargan for answering your phone calls, and Rhonda Fanning for technical direction. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.